The following message is copyrighted by Westminster Theological Seminary. Duplication, distribution, or other use of all or any part of this message is not permitted without prior written consent. Please direct your inquiries to communications@wts.edu. For all other information, please visit the main website at www.wts.edu.
I have a Bible here just in case I need to deal with the contradictions. I see the looks of disappointment on your face. I know the brute facts say that Mike Kelly was speaking today. Mike and I did a shift around early on the week, so I'm taking over from him today. It actually worked out well because it turned out that Mike got sick last night, so I'm here covering for him. Second caveat, as you know, those of you who faithfully follow my chapel talks over the years, I don't really do sermons, I do more like lectures, and be warned, today is more lectury than ever. I'll even talk about Hebrews. So you've got your Hebrew Bibles in front of you. I hope this isn't being taped because out there, or put on the web, that would be scary for people out there to hear this one. Anyway, here's where we're going. The title of this one is, This Temple is Our God, Toward a Christological Reading of Psalm 48. Psalm 48. We'll kind of work through it together once we open it up. No, I need to look at the clock here. We're good. This is by one of the sons of Korah. Now, the sons of Korah were devoted to the city of Jerusalem and especially to the temple that stood within it. Of the 11 or 12 psalms, depending on the way you count it, on the 11, say, psalms that were attributed to this group of Israelite poets, the Korahite psalms they're called, a surprisingly high proportion makes some very positive reference to the temple or to the city. The author of Psalm 42 and 43, you can read those as a combined psalm, he looks longingly back to the time when he led the procession to the house of the Lord, or the house of God. And he looks forward at the same time to the day when he would again be brought to the holy mountain, to the place that where you dwell. Psalm 46, really well-known psalm. It sings the praises of the city of God, the holy place where the Most High dwells. Psalm 84 opens with the words, How lovely is your dwelling place, O Lord Almighty. And then the psalmist goes on to speak about his desire to make a pilgrimage to the courts of the Lord. And in fact, he wishes he could dwell in the courts of the Lord, in the temple, or dwell in God's house. And he dramatically proclaims, better is one day in your courts, better is one day in the courts of your temple than 1,000 elsewhere. And in Psalm 89, famously echoed in the hymn that we just sang, for the John Newton hymn, Glorious Things of Thee Are Spoken, the Korahite psalmist declares, The Lord loves the gates of Zion. Glorious things are said of you, O city of God. And of course, we also have the psalm before us today, Psalm 48, with its poem of praise to the city where the great king dwelt. Now, we needn't ponder for too long, because I don't know the answer to this one, is why were the Korahites, why do they have this distinctive affection for Jerusalem and its temple? And now, both contextual and linguistic evidence suggest that this group of psalms were written by people from the northern kingdom. The Korahites actually lived in the northern kingdom of Israel sometime after it split from Judah. Perhaps this particular group of Korahites held fast to the position that right sacrifices to Yahweh could not be made at the high places of the northern kingdom, but only in Jerusalem, the place where the Lord had chosen as a dwelling place for his name forever, from Deuteronomy. Perhaps, and yes, I'm speculating, perhaps the relative inaccessibility of Jerusalem, they're up in the north and there's probably limits on how often they can go down to the south, perhaps that relative inaccessibility heightened their devotion to the city of Jerusalem and its temple. I don't know. I have a particular verse I want to focus on today, and it's the last verse of this psalm, verse 14. But let me just take a few minutes, just to skim through the psalm as a lead-in to my main comments. Okay, we'll just read through it. It's a song. It's a psalm of the sons of Korah. Great is the Lord and most worthy of praise in the city of our God, his holy mountain. It is beautiful in its loftiness, the joy of the whole earth. Like the utmost heights of Zaphon is Mount Zion, the city of the great king. Two other psalms contain what we have here as the opening words of Psalm 48. Great is the Lord and most worthy of praise. Those words, you know, find exact expression in two other psalms. But whereas in these other psalms continue in with praise for the Lord, Psalm 96 goes on with, great is the Lord, greatly to be praised. He is greatly to be feared among all the gods. And Psalm 145 continues, his greatness, the Lord's greatness, is no one can fathom. Psalm 48 does an interesting shift. It shifts surprisingly to a song of praise, not to God, but to the city of our God. In fact, as you read on, you might wonder, is this psalm a psalm in praise of God or Jerusalem? It seems that the two are being mixed together, but that's, I think, exactly the effect that the psalmist wants to achieve. In any event, we are told here that Mount Zion, the site of the Lord's temple, is the real Mount Zaphon, which is, as you all know, no doubt, in Canaanite theology, Mount Zaphon is the assembly place of the gods. It's where the pantheon meets. It's where the high god El presides over the pantheon. And what's going on here is the psalmist is saying, no, wrong place. The real Mount Zaphon, the real assembly of the gods, the real place where God lives on earth, it's not Mount Zaphon. It is, of course, it's Jerusalem. It's Mount Zion. It's a really striking thing that this Korahite author does, makes that equation of Zion to Mount Zaphon and saying it's, but Zion is the true mountain of God. And in saying that, he gives to Zion a kind of a quasi-mythical, otherworldly status. It's a strange and somewhat provocative thing to do, but that's what he's saying there. He goes on, God is in her citadels. He has shown himself to be her fortress. When the kings joined forces, when they advanced together, they saw her and they were astounded. They fled in terror. Trembling seized them there, pain like that of a woman in labor. You destroyed them like ships of Tarshish, shattered by an east wind. As we have heard, so we have seen. In the city of the Lord Almighty, in the city of our God, God makes her secure forever. Selah. What really strikes me about this section of the psalm is that the enemies that being referred to here do not even seem to attack the city. They arrive, they look at the city, they are terrified, they are destroyed. Now obviously it's God who's doing the destroying, but you get the impression that it is the mere sight of the city, so closely identified with God, that just simply puts the enemies to panic. They arrive, they look up and they're blown away. They're freaked out, as it were, when they see the city. First, the city terrifies, and then God blows them out of the water, perhaps literally. The psalm goes on. Within your temple, O God, we meditate upon your unfailing love. So what's happening now? The psalmist is now moving into the temple to ponder all that's happened. And he meditates upon God's unfailing love, his covenant faithfulness, which has been seen, of course, in the defeat of the enemies. The Lord came and rescued us. He showed his covenant faithfulness to us. Like your name, your reputation, O God, your praise reaches to the ends of the earth. Your right hand is filled with righteousness. Mount Zion rejoices. The villages of Judah are glad because of your judgments. What judgment? The judgment that he's executed on these enemies who are attacking the city. Now we come to a pretty crucial verse. Walk around Zion. Go around her. Count her towers. Just make sure they're all there. Consider well, literally set your heart towards her ramparts. The Hebrew word here is difficult. View, possibly, or maybe just pass around, pass between her citadels, that you may tell of them to the next generation. So what's going on here? Something like this. If you can't believe that Mount Zion, the city and the temple, survived the attack from the enemies, then take a walk around and look at the ramparts. Not only did they survive the attack, they are untouched, they are unscathed. But why would you be surprised? This is God's dwelling, the true heavenly mountain. It is untouchable. It is glorious. And we could keep going on describing the city. Walk around, check it out, and see how glorious it is and how untouched it is by all these enemy attacks. In fact, the psalmist's praise for the city seems to be a little overdone. Shouldn't he simply be singing God's praises? But he's singing so much the praises of the city. It's a little awkward for us, perhaps. John Goldingay, the commentator, seems a little uneasy about the psalmist's enthusiasm for the city. He says, the psalm goes within a whisker of glorifying the earthly might and defences rather than God. His uneasiness is telling. The psalmist seems to glory in the city as much as he glories in God. Now we come to the explanation for why the psalmist is enthusing so much over Mount Zion. And here I'm going to depart from the NIV. If you're following the NIV, I'm actually going to probably switch across to something closer to the ESV here. Here's how the Hebrew in the opening clause of verse 14 reads. Ki zeh Elohim. And I kind of want to point at one of my Hebrew students and say, translate that for me. Ki zeh Elohim. Keeping it fairly literal, this clause either completes the previous clause, walk around Zion, so that you can recount to later generations, key that this is God, our God, forever and ever, as the verse goes on. Or alternately, and I don't think it's going to make too much difference to the sense, the key there would be a causal key. It would read something like this. It gets a reason for why the Israelites should tell the next generation about the city and the temple and why he is spending so much time praising the city. Key, because this, Zeh, is God, our God. And as I said, I think I slightly prefer the second translation. Doesn't matter too much either way. But either way, you're left with a question. What is this? If this is God, then what is God? The way Zeh normally functions, this should refer to the city of our God, the great king. And more specifically, Zeh, this, should refer to the holy place within the city's citadels. In other words, the most natural reading for me of verse 14 has the psalmist walking around the city, and then at the end of his circumambulation, nice word, he points back to the city and especially to this temple and says, this, meaning this city, this temple mount, is God, our God forever and ever. Houston, we have a problem. An Orthodox Yahwist, an Orthodox worshiper of Yahweh, would never equate the temple, let alone the city, with God. Given that the sons of Korah, what they say in other temple-centered psalms, if this refers to the temple, I would expect this verse to say something like, this is the temple. This temple is where God dwells. That would be Orthodox. That would be typical of what the Korahites say, but it's actually not what this psalm says. This mountain city temple is God. Now, you can sense the translation struggling at this point. Some, like the RSV, the ESV, New King James, do preserve what I think is a literal sense. This is God. And they just leave it there, sitting there for the interpreters to figure out what's going on. Others, as far back as the King James and today the NIV, they treat the this there as a demonstrative pronoun. Okay, we're into first semester Hebrew. And it translated, this God is our God. But grammatically speaking, I think that's unlikely. The construction is pretty straightforward. This is the subject of a verbless clause. Others take this to refer to everything that the psalm has been talking about, like all of this stuff is about God, or as a lot of translations do it, the NASB, the New Jerusalem Bible, such is God. In other words, this, everything I've been talking about, is what God is like. Maybe, but again, I think unlikely. My favorite translation is the Jewish publication's Tanakh translation. For God, he is our God forever. And you can kind of figure out why they're doing that. For obvious reasons, most modern Jewish interpreters are going to be a little uncomfortable about including something which is not God in the definition of God. commentators have an easier path with this problem. They can, and most often do, simply ignore the problem and comment on other elements in the verse. But occasionally, you've noticed that, haven't you? We've worked with commentaries, how useless they are. The one question you want them to ask, they don't answer. Happens all the time. Occasionally, though, some commentators will courageously grasp the nettle and try to explain what the reasonably clear sense of the Hebrew, "this is God," might mean. Of the commentaries I looked at, I think the bravest was Peter Craigie. Brave, because he understands "this is God" to mean "this mountain is." He says literally, quote now, "this mountain is, in a sense, God." I like that. "This mountain is, in a sense, God." The mountain, the city, the temple is God. Pause as you ponder what that might mean, but then he gets you, and especially himself, off the hook by adding, "in a sense." So in what sense, then, is the Temple Mount God? Craigie replies, well, in a symbolic sense. And it's something like this: the reality and the eternality of the Temple Mount symbolizes God's real and eternal presence with his people. It's kind of like a simile. The Temple Mount is like God. The clearest statement of what I'm calling this the Protestant interpretation of the verse. Protestant, well, you'll see why in a minute. I think the clearest statement of this particular line of interpretation comes from Craig Broyles, who says, "This mountain is God" means the battlements and other defenses on this mountain symbolize, but are clearly not to be identified with our God. You can probably see why I'm calling it the Protestant approach to this verse. "This is my body" for Protestants means this bread symbolizes or stands for my body. Similarly, what most interpreters do here is this temple mountain symbolizes or stands for God. It has to be this way, doesn't it? A mountain cannot be God. A city, a temple, even a city or a temple with God dwelling in its midst, cannot itself actually be divine. You know what I'm going to do now. Or can it? What if we consider the impossible? What happens if we try to read this verse a little more literally, dare I say it, in a more Catholic way? So that "this is God" comes closer to meaning this city, mountain, temple that you have just walked around is God. Okay, and I'll be safe here. I'll add the obligatory "in some way." In Psalm 27, interesting psalm, and this is just one entry point to a large issue, David writes, "One thing I've asked the Lord that I will seek after, that I may dwell in the house of the Lord all the days of my life, to gaze upon the beauty of the Lord and to inquire in his temple." Okay, when pilgrims came to the temple to gaze upon the beauty of the Lord, what did they actually gaze upon? I think the answer is the temple. Or more accurately, the temple perhaps and its furnishings. What I'm getting at here is that in the ancient Israelite worldview, because God dwelt in the temple, God and the temple became so closely connected that in some way, God's divinity attached to the temple. The temple was understood to share in Yahweh's identity in some way. Or to put it a little differently, the temple was seen as an extension of or a manifestation of God himself, a kind of a theophany in stone, as it were. Gary Anderson, who I'm kind of relying upon here, and of course he's a Catholic, no surprise, he writes, "The aura of the deity's presence was so overwhelming that all parts of the temple compound came to share in its effulgence, its radiance, its glory." I think something similar is going on in Psalm 48. God has become so identified with Mount Zion, the city, and most obviously the temple. He dwells there. The city is likened to the heavenly mountain. He's so identified with the city and the temple that the city itself came to be understood as being in some way sharing in his divinity. So the psalmist, in a manner typical of the Korahites, with powerful, hyperbolic, press-the-envelope imagery, he can point to the city temple and declare, "This is God." Not just that it symbolizes God or stands for God, but rather in some way it actually divinity attaches to this temple, this city, this mountain. Anderson tries to explain it this way. I like this. He says, to use a modern metaphor, one might imagine the temple as a giant electrical generating plant that powered the land of Israel. In its core was a nuclear reactor in which the radioactive rods emitted divine energy that was absorbed by the entire infrastructure of the building. Though the glow was brightest in the center, even the periphery had to be entered and handled with caution. Not even the thickest cement wall or lead surface could prevent these divine energies, and that's the best term, but that's what he says, these divine energies from overwhelming their boundaries and radiating divinity upon whatever stood in its vicinity. No wonder all the enemies fled in terror when they saw the city. They were terrified because when they looked on the city, and obviously the temples at its heart, in some sense, they saw God. They saw a physical manifestation of him. The temple is not quite God incarnate, but it is God in template. Okay, Latin templus, temple, you know, I'm trying to play with it. God becoming a temple. I'm suggesting, therefore, that it is within the bounds of Orthodox Israelite monotheism to say that in some way, the word Yahweh, the word God, can include the temple in its definition. Or to put it this way, the concept of God cannot be limited to Yahweh. It includes Yahweh plus his physical manifestations. Now, before you dismiss this as crazed heresy, which you probably will, I challenge you to think canonically, to think eschatologically, to think Christologically, and if there's such a word, to think Trinitarianly. And then read John's Gospel, where the Apostle, and then remember John's Gospel, where the Apostle tells us that the word God includes a temple within its definition. Jesus is the true temple. He tabernacled among us. In other words, he was a movable temple in our midst. That's John 1:14. In John 2, the temple he had spoken of was his body, and so on throughout John. John basically presents Jesus as the true eschatological temple. So how could a good Jew like John so easily accept that Jesus was with God and was God? How could John, in effect, tell his readers to walk around Jesus and then point to him and say, this is God, our God forever and ever? How could a Jew like John worship Jesus as God? And how could he convince other his Jewish audience to make that same move that he had made? I think the answer is in part, maybe just in part, it was because the Old Testament itself had made the first baby steps in that direction. By calling the temple God, yes, with all the qualifications you need to attach to that, Psalm 48 opens up an Israelite-Jewish door to understanding Jesus, who is the eschatological temple, as divine. It's the first move in that direction. In other words, God's incarnational, or in this case, his intemplational impulse, his impulse to exist in tangible, physical form finds expression in this intriguing psalm. This is God, our God forever. And it turns out that he is more physical, more spatial than we might first have thought. So if the unnamed Korahite psalmist waxed so enthusiastically about the temple city of Jerusalem, how much more excited would he have been, and should we be, about Jesus? The sight of him now strikes terror in the hearts of the enemy kings. No longer the kings from Tarshish, but the dark principalities and powers, Ephesians 6. It is in him, it is in the true city temple of our God that we find refuge. So the temple is a place that terrifies the enemies, but where the people of God find refuge, is that not who Jesus is for us? The Korahite psalmist invited his readers to consider the glory, the strength, and beauty of the temple city, its towers, its ramparts, and citadels. But those physical features are a mere foreshadowing of a greater glory, a greater strength, and a greater beauty. The New Testament calls on us to take a guided tour of Jesus, to walk around him, as it were, to consider him well, to view him closely in all his surprising glory. And when we do that, we too will say, this temple, this Jesus is God, our God, forever and ever. Let's close in prayer. Our God, we thank you that you have brought us into the safety of the true temple. You have brought us into Jesus. We have found refuge in him. And now, as we walk around him, as we read the Gospels, we read the epistles, and we get this picture of Jesus, and we see how beautiful, how strong, how majestic, how glorious he is, how divine he is. And we bow before him. We say, this is our God. Father, we thank you for this Old Testament writer who, whether he knew it or not, pointed us towards Jesus. Help us to read our Old Testaments with one eye open towards Jesus. Help us to do our work in a way that gives glory and honor to him. And we pray this in his name. Amen.